you've got to go step by step and counter the reasons for the skepticism while at the same time not criticizing people for their skepticism, but respecting their skepticism, and that hopefully you'll win over at least a portion of the people who have hesitancy about vaccinations.
That is Dr. Anthony Fauci, and this is a broadcast of the 2021 Mansfield Lecture from the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. In this conversation and public Q&A, Fauci, who is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, answers questions from moderator Rob Saldine and other Montanans about the transformational role of vaccines in the COVID-19 pandemic, the challenges of vaccine distribution and vaccine hesitancy, what lessons we can learn from the past year, and what sort of normal we may be able to return to. You'll also hear a Montana colleague of Dr. Fauci's, Dr. Marshall Bloom, Associate Director for Science Management for Rocky Mountain Laboratories in Hamilton, Montana, a campus of the NIAID. More than 6,000 viewers tuned in for this live Zoom event on February 17, 2021. Seth Bodner, President of the University of Montana, and Dina Mansour, Executive Director of the Mansfield Center, started things off.
Hello, my name is Seth Bodner, and as the President of the University of Montana, I want to welcome everyone to this exciting Mansfield Center lecture with Dr. Anthony Fauci. Here at the University of Montana, we always begin important events by acknowledging that our university is situated in the Aboriginal territories of the Salish and Kalispell people. We always strive to honor the path they've shown us in caring for this place for generations to come. And today's Mansfield Lecture is an expression of this commitment to providing a public good for people today and generations of tomorrow. The Mansfield Center's mission to foster globally minded leaders of integrity and to bolster our democratic institutions is central to our university's mission. Just as Dr. Fauci has devoted his life and expertise in the service of others, we at the University of Montana exist to serve our community with integrity and with a fervent commitment to fostering inclusive prosperity. As a public institution contributing to the common good in fighting this pandemic, we are proud to lend our research and educational expertise to this global challenge. And I want to thank our close partners at Rocky Mountain Labs, Dr. Marshall Bloom and UM alum Ken Pico, for helping to arrange this terrific event today. I also want to welcome the thousands of people joining us this afternoon. We're honored you've chosen to be with us today, and I am honored to welcome Dr. Anthony Fauci to our university. I'll now hand it over to the Executive Director of the Mansfield Center, Dina Mansour.
I'm pleased to join President Bodner in welcoming you to the 2021 Mansfield Lecture featuring Dr. Anthony Fauci. Montana's Mike Mansfield rose from a rough childhood, service in three branches of the military and the Butte Copper Mines to become our nation's longest serving Senate Majority Leader, as well as U.S. Ambassador to Japan under both Presidents Reagan and Carter. The Mansfield Center was created by an act of Congress to honor Senator Mansfield's legacy of statesmanship, ethics, and civility. We foster globally minded leaders of integrity within our mission to foster global mutual understanding, as well as ethics and public affairs. The Mansfield Center Lecture was created in 1968 to serve as a forum for the vital issues facing our world. One speaker that stands out to me is Daniel Ellsberg, who spoke to the lessons of Vietnam in October 1975. It is this tradition of service and moral courage that we celebrate to this day. We honor Dr. Fauci today while honoring dozens of our public health workers in Missoula by sharing these special Fauci donuts with them today. Thanks to Dr. Marshall Bloom of Rocky Mountain Labs for turning us on to this nationwide phenomenon of the Fauci donuts. Our programs are woven together by today's moderator, Dr. Robert Saldine, director of the Mansfield Ethics and Public Affairs Program. A professor of political science, Rob has served as a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Scholar in Health Policy at Harvard University, has written a book on the politics of health policy, and regularly teaches a course on health policy here at the University of Montana. Rob, thank you for joining us today and moderating this conversation.
Welcome everyone to this year's Mansfield Lecture with Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, of course, is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a position that he's held since 1984. As part of that role, he oversees the Institute's Rocky Mountain Laboratories just down the road in Hamilton, Montana, and is responsible for those laboratories becoming such a powerhouse in research on infectious diseases. Dr. Fauci has also been a close advisor to seven presidents, including President Biden. He's played a major role in the U.S. response to a number of pandemics, including HIV/AIDS, Ebola, West Nile virus, Zika, and COVID-19. He is quite simply the country's most respected and trusted spokesperson on infectious diseases. Dr. Fauci, it is truly an honor to have you with us today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's really a great pleasure to be here with you. I look forward to the dialogue of this chat. And this is such an important situation we're in right now with COVID-19. And I really am looking forward to the opportunity to have a really robust discussion with all of you.
Well, fantastic. For last year's Mansfield Lecture, which was about 11 months ago, we hosted New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof in an auditorium here on campus in front of a crowd of over 1,000 people. And that was actually my last large gathering before COVID hit. At that time, we all knew this thing was coming, but I certainly had no real understanding of the extent to which this was going to upend our lives, the number of deaths it would cause, how long it would last. But looking back, from your perspective, has this pandemic played out in the U.S. and around the world as you expected, or has it surprised you?
Well, I would have to be very honest and tell you it really has surprised me. People have often asked me, since I've been involved in so many outbreaks, some of rather trivial importance, although they were interesting, and others of extraordinary impact. I mean, dating all the way back to the very early years of HIV/AIDS in 1981, as you mentioned, several of them, pandemic flu, Zika, Ebola, the anthrax attacks, which we thought were bioterror, as actually homegrown terror, as it were. And now people have always asked me, what is your worst nightmare as an infectious disease scientist and public health official? And they've been asking me that question literally for decades. And the answer has really been quite consistent. And that is the emergence of a new pathogen, generally a virus, that's a jumping species from an animal to a human, that's respiratory borne, that has two concurrent characteristics. A, it has an extraordinary capability of transmitting very efficiently from human to human. And two, it has the capability of a high degree of morbidity and mortality, either in general population or among some specific groups. And unfortunately, we are living through that, quote, worst nightmare, in the sense that we are seeing now, with over 480,000 deaths thus far in the United States, with 27 million infections and over 2.3 million deaths worldwide, we are living through the worst example of a respiratory-borne pandemic in over 100 years since the iconic 1918 influenza. So the short answer to your question, Rob, this is really beyond what I imagined. When this first came in January and February of last year of 2020, we were all hoping that by the time we got to the summer with the warmer weather, that this respiratory-borne virus essentially would have burned itself out. And nothing could have been further from the truth, as we are now well into a year and we still now have a surge that, although it's turning around a bit, is extraordinary, with just a few weeks ago having 2 to 3 and as many as 400,000 new cases a day and up to 3,000 to 4,000 deaths per day. I don't think anyone could have imagined that things would have been this bad for over a year. We're making a lot of progress now, but we have been through a very, very extraordinary and historic experience that isn't over yet.
Well, I for one, am certainly glad that I didn't know the extent of what this would look like back a year ago. But it also strikes me that, you know, just a little over a year ago, no one had ever heard the term COVID-19. And now we're at a place where people are complaining that they can't get a vaccine. And of course, on the one hand, it's entirely understandable that people are frustrated. They're eager to get back to normal. But on the other hand, despite what a tough year this has been, it seems that we fail to appreciate just how remarkable it is that we managed to develop an effective vaccines, plural, I should say, in this short amount of time. Can you say a bit about how we managed to achieve that? And also, given that the vaccines were developed so quickly, how we can be so sure that they're as safe and effective as we're told?
Okay, so let's take a look at the timeline, which will speak for itself. The Chinese recognized this unusual form of pneumonia in December of 2019. Likely there were infections that were going on in the Wuhan district prior to that, but they first made known this unusual clinical syndrome. On the 10th of January, they published in a public database the sequence of what turned out to be a novel coronavirus. Within a period of days, because of the extraordinary scientific advances in vaccine platform technology and in structure-based vaccine design, we began the development of a vaccine literally 5 days later. And 62 days later, we started the phase one trial. And on July 27th, we started a phase three trial. When I say we, I'm talking about the NIH together with the Moderna company, but Pfizer was doing the same thing, as was other companies. 11 months later, in December, we were putting the first doses of a highly successful and highly efficacious vaccine that had a good safety profile into the arms of individuals. This is beyond unprecedented. To have a vaccine for a new pathogen in far less than a year from the time you recognize the pathogen is something that if anyone told any of us with experience in vaccinology, could this have been possible? We would have all said absolutely not. But it was the extraordinary advances in science which anteceded this, which allowed us to do that. Now to your question of having gone so fast, how do we know it's safe and effective? As I mentioned, the speed did not compromise safety. It was merely a reflection of the evolution of extraordinary science. But the question is, how do you know it's safe and effective? I mean, for the vaccine doubters, the people who have skepticism, who would say, is this the federal government maybe trying to pull something over on us? Is this the pharmaceutical company trying to make a lot of money? How do we know it's safe and effective? Well, first of all, the clinical trials that were done were 30,000 people in the Moderna trial and 44,000 people in the Pfizer trial. The decision of whether or not it's safe and effective was made by a completely independent body called the Data Safety Monitoring Board, which is not beholden to the federal government nor to the pharmaceutical company, but it's beholden to the citizens of this country because they are a completely independent group of vaccinologists, immunologists, virologists, statisticians, as well as individuals in the field of ethics. They looked at the data and they made a determination that this was a 94 to 95% effective vaccine. The FDA, who's responsible for the final approval, or at least for the emergency use authorization, the career scientists looked at that and together with their own advisory committee called the VRBPAC, that group made the recommendation that the vaccine was okay to give out and disseminate among the population in the United States. So for people who have skepticism, they need to understand that the entire process was both transparent and independent. And that's something that I think we need to emphasize because of the unusual nature of how quickly we got to this very favorable position of more than one vaccine being highly efficacious and quite safe.
Well, I want to get your thoughts on some prominent debates going on right now in epidemiological and public health circles. So Michael Osterholm, a prominent epidemiologist, and others have recently been making the case that we should consider adjusting our approach to the two-dose vaccines because of the rapid spread of these new variants that are potentially more contagious and severe. The two-dose regimen for the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are around 95% effective, while a single dose might be only around 60% effective. But Osterholm is saying that if we want to stay ahead of these mutations, that we may be better off getting one dose into as many people as possible right now and spreading around at least that partial level of protection as widely as we can. What do you think about this? Do you think shifting our approach to vaccines in this way is a good idea, given the changing situation with regard to these new mutations?
Well, Mike Osterholm is an old and dear friend of mine, but as I've told him, I disagree with him. And many of the people involved in this field also. And the fact is, what we're doing is we're doing on the basis of the science. We have a good scientific basis to tell us that the optimal approach is a prime followed by a boost, 21 days with Pfizer, 28 days with Moderna. We know we get 94 to 95% efficacy, and we know it's durable. If we go ahead and do one dose instead of two in order to stretch it out, we do not know how durable it is, and it's suboptimal protection. Now, I understand the rationale why people are proposing that, but the rationale has some weaknesses. For example, if you have a less than effective vaccine, that could help to select for even more mutants. When you have a very potently effective vaccine that you've proven by good scientific trials, then we're going to stick with the scientific data. It is true that the demand is far greater than the supply of vaccines, but we will soon be getting a single dose vaccine with Johnson or J&J. And as we get more doses, one of the things that Dr. Osterholm and his colleagues said, well, why don't we study it? Because I had said, well, we don't have any data. Why don't we study it? I agree, that would be really good if we could study it. The only trouble is, in order to study a single dose of our product versus a prime boost, it would take several months and thousands of people in yet again a new clinical trial. By the time that clinical trial gave us the appropriate data, then by that time, we will already have enough vaccine to give anybody who wants it a prime and a boost. Because if we go and it takes several months, you're talking about going into the late spring, early summer. And by that time, we will have the 600 million doses that we contracted for. So although conceptually and theoretically, it would be a good idea to see if you could get away with a single dose, even though the studies were really reflecting a prime and a boost, it would take long enough to get there that by that time it would be a moot point.
Okay, so another issue that's cropped up recently are some strategic differences among states with regard to how they distribute these vaccines. So you've got some states like California and New York that have been relatively strict about adhering to the various tiers, the 1A, the 1B, and so on, that mandate who's supposed to get the vaccine and when. Critics say that being overly obsessed with those details, though, has slowed the process of actually getting people vaccinated, and in some cases has even resulted in doses of the vaccine being thrown away lest they go to someone who isn't eligible. Meanwhile, you've got other states like West Virginia that have been much looser about enforcing whose turn it is and have instead prioritized just burning through their doses of the vaccine as quickly as they can on the notion that it's much more important just to get as many people vaccinated as fast as possible. What's the right balance to strike here?
Well, I think the right balance to strike is to form some fundamental principles. And one of the important principles is that you should never be in a situation when you have a real gap between supply and demand to ever have doses of vaccine that are sitting around, not being used, or even worse, are being wasted and essentially not being used at all. That we should never let happen, particularly because of the increased demand, which outstrips the supply. You really need to be flexible. And what certain states are doing it one way, others the other way, trying to get the best out of what they have. But one of the things we should appreciate is that it is far more of a problem that we don't have enough vaccine for the demand of people who want it. So that whether you do it according to the strict recommendation of phase 1A, 1B, 1C, or whether you make it more flexible and open, the bottom line is until the supply begins to become closer matched to the demand, there's always going to be this problem that we're facing. I would think as we get into the months of late March and through April and then May, as we get many, many more doses of vaccine available, this problem will go away. But right now, it is an issue that we need to address.
Well, both the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines being administered in Montana and the rest of the country, they're based on the mRNA platform. But there are going to be others, like the AstraZeneca vaccine, which appear to me to be quite different. Do all of these provide the same level of protection, the same good protection that we associate with the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine? And will having these different options widely available in the coming months, is that going to facilitate or complicate our ability to vaccinate people?
Well, I believe it's going to facilitate. We don't know the full efficacy in this country of all the candidates, but the ones that we do know seem to fall a bit short in overall efficacy against early to moderate disease. For example, the J&J is 72% effective in the United States. It has also been tested in South Africa. And in South Africa that has a variant that has eluded the protection of the vaccine, even though it diminishes by about fivefold the efficacy of the vaccine, it doesn't eliminate it completely. So there is some protection against this different strain, namely the South African mutant. So when you look at J&J, 72% effective is obviously not as good as 94 to 95% effective. But there is value added to have that vaccine for a number of reasons. One, it's a single dose. You need to take that into consideration. Number two, the cold chain requirements are far less stringent. You could keep it in a refrigerator instead of needing a very stringent minus 70 to 90 cold chain requirement. And it's capable of making billions of doses by J&J or Janssen company. So even though the number is a bit different, still it's value added. The AZ is a bit more complicated. They've had a complicated clinical trial in the UK and other countries. We're waiting right now for the closing and the data on the phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trial of AZ in the United States. Novavax is another one that is also being tested in the United States and in other countries. And that is one that thus far has shown to have about a 90% efficacy in the UK, which we don't believe is much different now, even though they have that 117 variant, which is starting to populate us here in the United States. So there will be different numbers and there will be different levels of efficacy. What seems to be the common denominator is that they all do very well in preventing severe disease leading to hospitalizations and deaths. But each of them have their own characteristics, which would make them be of value in one circumstance versus another.
Well, Dr. Fauci, ahead of this session, the Mansfield Center invited people who registered for the event to send in their questions. And we were happy to be overwhelmed with over 400 questions. And the primary question on a lot of people's minds is some version of, when are we going to be back to normal? So for instance, Billy Miller from Helena, Montana asks about visiting grandkids after getting vaccinated. Is that safe to do? And is it safe to do without masks and social distancing? Riley Johnson, I think speaking for high school students across the country, Riley is from Pablo, Montana, is wondering, you know, what's school going to look like next year? Is it going to look more like the old pre-COVID normal or more like it has this year?
Yeah, I think that one can comfortably say that we don't know the precise answer to that, but I can give you a reasonable idea. And it really relates to the fact that the light at the end of the tunnel of a very difficult period that we've been through is the fact that we have vaccines that are highly efficacious and safe. And when we get the overwhelming majority of the country vaccinated, and when I say overwhelming majority, I'm talking maybe 70 to 85% of the population, which would give us, in my estimation, even though it's not definitive because we don't know precisely, that would give us a level of what we call herd immunity, which means the protection or a blanket or an umbrella of protection over the community would be such that there would be very, very low level of viral dynamics in the community. When that occurs, we believe, given the pace of vaccinations that are occurring now, and if we could get past this issue of vaccine hesitancy, where a significant number of people may not want to get vaccinated, if we can convince them to get vaccinated and get to that 70 to 85% of the population vaccinated, I believe that by next fall, middle to end of the fall, that we can begin to approach a significant degree of normality. That doesn't mean it's going to be exactly the way it was before. It may mean that we still, under certain circumstances, would have to wear a mask. I mean, we might get back to activities that we don't do now, like being in restaurants, maybe not at full capacity, going to the theater, going to a movie, you know, going back to school, feeling very comfortable and going back to school. I believe we will be there by the time we get to the mid-fall of this coming year. And by the year, we might even be much closer to that. The one wild card in this that I think we need to pay attention to is the emergence of variants, which could elude some of the protection of the vaccine. If that's the case, we are already preparing to make versions of the vaccine that are specifically directed at the variants in question. So in answer to the questioners who asked you about that, we will be approaching a degree of normality as we go into the fall, but the exact extent of it is going to depend upon a number of factors that we don't have complete control over.
Okay, well, you've mentioned now a couple times skepticism about the vaccine, and I want to bring in Kaylee Kronsberger now. Kaylee is an undergraduate student here at the University of Montana studying human biological sciences, and she has a question for you on that point about skepticism. Kaylee.
Hi. So I'm from Eureka, Montana, which is a rural town. The idea of people being opposed to vaccines in general is not new to me. I've shadowed doctors multiple times in my hometown, and every time the physicians express their concerns, about the general population's refusal to vaccinate children with their routine immunizations. With this distrust in years of science and research, how do you expect rural physicians approach the idea of vaccinating the public with a new vaccine? And how do you recommend healthcare professionals convey the importance of this vaccine when people still refuse to do things like wear masks or socially distance?
You know, Kaylee, there's not an easy answer to that question because, I mean, you've experienced in your location in Montana skepticism about childhood vaccinations. I think rather than being hypercritical of people who have skepticism, I think we need all of us to respect that skepticism, but to be in a very patient, measured way, explain condition by condition of why it's important to get vaccinated and what is the reason for the skepticism. It is that it's a new vaccine, true, but it has been tested in tens and tens of thousands of people, and it has been shown to be highly efficacious and really quite safe. Another objection is, well, vaccines usually take multiple years to develop. You've done this in less than a year. And then, as I mentioned before, explain that the speed is due to extraordinary scientific advances that doesn't compromise safety, nor does it compromise scientific integrity. So you've got to go step by step and counter the reasons for the skepticism while at the same time not criticizing people for their skepticism, but respecting their skepticism, and that hopefully you'll win over at least a portion of the people who have hesitancy about vaccinations.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci in a Zoom conversation with the Mansfield Center's Rob Saldine and several other Montanans that took place on February 17th. We'll be right back. We return now to a conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the 2021 Mansfield Lecturer from the Mansfield Center at the University of Montana.
Well, I'd like to have Shelley Fian, Chairwoman of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, join us for a related question about one of Montana's vulnerable populations. Chairwoman.
Thank you. It's such an honor to meet you, Dr. Fauci, and thank you to the Mansfield Center for this opportunity to ask Dr. Fauci a question on behalf of Indian Country. Also wanted to thank President Bodnar for the land acknowledgement. That means a lot to the Salish and Kootenai people. So my question is, what is your response to our tribal community members who ask us, how do you expect us to trust a vaccine being sent by the federal government, which is systematically decimated our people, experimented on our people, sterilized our mothers, placed our grandmothers in tuberculosis sanitariums as treatment only to withhold and deny available treatment, and underfund our only healthcare system?
That's a very important question, Shelley, and I'm glad that you asked it because it's what's happening in real life and people who have skepticism. And as I mentioned just a bit ago, you have to respect the people who have that skepticism because you're absolutely correct, not only for Native Americans, but also for African Americans and Hispanics. I mean, if you look at the history of the federal medical programs in the infamous Tuskegee experiments from decades and decades ago, it's a good reason why African Americans have that same skepticism. As you know, the federal government does not have exactly a good track record of how they've treated Native Americans. And so skepticism is understandable. But what has happened since those times is that ethical constraints and ethical guidelines have come into place that would make anything that even smacks of being unethical impossible to do because of institutional review boards, data and safety monitoring boards, that never can happen. The reason why it's so important to overcome that resistance is that when you look at the disease burden that is borne by minority populations, including Native Americans, you suffer disproportionately from COVID-19. The incidence of infection is higher because you're out in the community going face to face with people who are spreading the infection, and you have underlying medical conditions called comorbidities that are prone to get you to have a more severe outcome once you get infected. For example, diabetes, hypertension, chronic lung disease, obesity. Those are the things that make it more likely that you'll have a serious outcome. In my mind, as a physician and as a healthcare person, it would be doubly tragic if, on the one hand, you suffered disproportionately from the outbreak, but on the other hand, you do not allow yourself the advantage of the one intervention that we know absolutely is life-saving. That would be doubly tragic for Native Americans. One, to have suffered in the beginning for the reasons that you mentioned, to disproportionately suffer from COVID-19, and yet to deprive yourself of a vaccine that's highly efficacious. I would find that very troubling.
Thank you, Dr. Fauci.
Well, let's bring in now someone who has been at the center of dealing with Montana's response to the pandemic since the very beginning. Greg Holzman is our state medical officer at the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services. Greg.
Thank you. It's an honor to be able to ask you a question, Dr. Fauci, somebody I've admired and watched from afar throughout my career. My question is, we have seen a lot of attrition in critical governmental public health and science-based positions at the federal, state, and local level. There's been much concern about the loss of people with significant scientific knowledge who provide essential mentorship in government over the last few years. How would you strategize to rebuild the scientific ranks within governmental public health? And what words of guidance would you give to a new graduate considering a career in governmental research, health policy, or public health?
Well, Greg, I mean, you're absolutely right. We need to continue to get more and more people involved in public service that relates to health and science, what you're referring to, government programs and people in government who are doing the kinds of things that are essentially geared to protecting the health of the general public in the United States and indirectly worldwide. I think one of the things that's the best seller for that is the extraordinary impact one can have at the government level by making contributions that the benefits of which would be experienced literally by millions of people in the country. To me, there's no more gratifying and satisfying feeling to know that when you get up and go to work in the morning and do what you do in a program that's a government public health or scientific program, that your impact goes well beyond your immediate circle and impacts people in different states and different regions and in different countries. So I think when you get people to appreciate that, we can recruit a lot more young people into the fields that we're in right now. So I think we just need to sell it a little bit better because it's such an exciting field. I still get excited every day when I get up and do what I have to do every day. And I've been doing it for a very long time. So if it could be sustained for that long period of time, it's at least worth young people taking a look at.
Well, Dr. Fauci, we also received a lot of questions about how the pandemic is affecting kids. Now, while the disruptions caused by COVID have certainly impacted schools and whatnot, we are fortunate in the sense that this pandemic has largely spared children of its worst consequences. But then there also seems to be this widespread assumption that kids are almost immune from the virus, and that's not accurate. I'd like to bring in a couple Missoulians, Lisa Beard, an emergency room nurse, and her 13-year-old son, Hudson, who contracted the virus a few months ago. They join us today from Community Children's at Community Medical Center. Lisa and Hudson.
First of all, Dr. Fauci, I want to thank you for devoting your life to work to help alleviate the suffering caused by so many horrific viruses and diseases around the world. I believe that you were called for such a time as this. We want to share our story so that people realize that COVID in children can be extremely severe with complicated long-term side effects. Children are not immune to COVID, and we are seeing more cases of COVID in children in all demographics. My son Hudson was an energetic, healthy, honor roll soccer player seventh grader and got hit with COVID in mid-November. While my husband and other young son recovered, Hudson continued to decline. Now, 3 months later, Hudson is living in constant pain. He has dizziness, migraine headaches, nerve dysfunction affecting his heart rate and often affects his breathing at night. His eyes are so affected that he can't read or write. He also has enlarged heart arteries, a malfunctioning intestine, liver toxicity, swollen lymph nodes throughout his abdomen, and continued nausea and vomiting and weakness of his left side that looks similar to a stroke. We have seen many specialists, and we have a team here with a good primary and prayers from around the world for him. And we've continued to see specialists outside of Montana at Colorado Children's Hospital as to why Hudson's body is being affected like a tornado. I would like for my son Hudson to ask you a question, Dr. Fauci.
Hi, Dr. Fauci.
Hi, Hudson.
Every day when I wake up, I have constant migraines, severe headaches, and I'm super dizzy. My stomach hurts, I vomit, my heart races, and I can't read or write. No other doctors can help me. Can you help me?
You know, Hudson, I don't know if I can help you right now, but I can tell you that your mother is absolutely correct. There is a misinterpretation about this, that children are completely immune to any serious effects. Some children get infected and a couple of weeks later, they get a very severe syndrome called multisystem inflammatory syndrome of children that is very, very difficult, very devastating, could lead to very severe consequences. In adults, we see something that we see less often in children, but you are a manifestation of that, of people who get a classic COVID-19 illness, but then instead of recovering, they get multi-system chronic signs and symptoms that can be mild or it can be debilitating. We don't know enough about it, Hudson, for me to honestly tell you what's going to happen over the next couple of months to a year. But what we hope that there is spontaneous recovery from this so that whatever aberrant mechanisms are going on in your body. Clearly, the virus triggered something in your system. So even though you don't have the virus in you anymore, it triggered something that has gotten out of control. And we hope that the body's own mechanisms will recalibrate and over a period of time, get you back to normal. I can't promise you that, but I'm hoping that for you and for other children like you, that that's the case, that this will be an unfortunate prolongation of suffering from this syndrome, but that might ultimately correct itself. We're working very hard to figure out what this post-acute COVID syndrome is. It has a name. It's called PACS, P-A-C-S, post-acute COVID syndrome. And you're not alone, Hudson. There are many, many people who have the same thing as you do. Most of them are adults, but like you, some of them are actually children. So let's hope that as we get forward in the coming months, that those things that are bothering you so much will self-correct.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I want to take a little bit of a step back and ask you just what are some of the main lessons that you draw from our experience with COVID-19? You know, assuming we do have a return to something resembling normal, what does the COVID-19 experience suggest to you about how we should go about preparing for future pandemics?
Well, there's so many lessons, Rob. One of them is don't ever underestimate an emerging pathogen, a new virus, because you really cannot predict how bad it will be when it first occurs. You know, in answer to a prior question of yours, this is something well beyond anything that we could have predicted. Number two, we were not adequately prepared. And hopefully the big lesson in this is that we will now globally have a global health security network, as we call it, where the interactions, communication, and collaboration among nations would be such that as soon as something emerges, we'll be able to communicate with each other about it as quickly as we possibly can. The other lesson is the importance of fundamental basic science in getting to solutions to problems associated with outbreaks. If we did not have the years of investment in biomedical research that antedated this outbreak by a decade or more, we never would have been able to come up with a vaccine in such an unprecedented period of time of less than a year from the time that this virus was first recognized. So those are just three or four of the many lessons that we've learned from this experience.
Well, Dr. Fauci, I know you have a busy schedule and need to move on to your next commitment, but on behalf of the Mansfield Center and the University of Montana, I want to thank you for joining us today and speaking directly to Montanans.
Thank you very much, Rob, for giving me the opportunity. It's been a real pleasure to be with you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dr. Fauci. Well, for our final segment of the session today, we are very fortunate to have one of Dr. Fauci's preeminent colleagues located right here in Montana, Dr. Marshall Bloom of the Rocky Mountain Labs. In 2002, Dr. Fauci appointed Dr. Bloom Associate Director for Science Management at the Rocky Mountain Labs. And aside from a two-year assignment at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, Dr. Bloom has been at the Rocky Mountain Labs dating back all the way to 1972. He's an authority on virology and biocontainment and has played an instrumental role in the lab's COVID-19 response while also serving as the lab's principal spokesperson during the pandemic. He's also been an advisor on COVID-19 to local and state officials and to public schools. And Dr. Bloom is also, I should mention, a good friend of the Mansfield Center and the University of Montana. Marshall, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Rob. It's always a pleasure to watch Dr. Fauci talk about something, that he obviously knows a lot about and even more importantly, really cares a lot about. You know, I've known him for, decades and known him very well for about three decades. There are just a couple of things that I want to mention before I talk about what I think stood out from his talk. There are two episodes which he didn't mention, which I think are worth noting. One, he's almost personally responsible for something called the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief in Africa. And this is a program which started in 2003 under the leadership of George W. Bush. And Dr. Fauci and President George W. Bush became very good friends. This is a program which has literally saved somewhere in the neighborhood of about 17 million lives in sub-Saharan Africa. That in and of itself is a phenomenal contribution. And then during the West African outbreak of Ebola virus about 5 years ago, the clinical center, which is the big hospital on the main National Institutes of Health campus, admitted some patients with Ebola virus to care for them in a special part of the hospital that's called the Special Studies Unit. And because these patients had Ebola virus, the healthcare workers taking care of them had to take extraordinary precautions and wear all kinds of personal protective equipment, which now a lot of us are familiar with seeing. Dr. Fauci was one of the doctors who took care of the nurse that was actually the first patient in the clinical center. And he took night call. He would garb up and go in and render care to the patient. And then when she was discharged, he posed with her outside the NIH clinical center. And he was asked, someone in your position, why are you taking these particular measures? And his response was something like, I'm not going to ask the people that work for me to do something that I'm not going to do myself. I hope that those two anecdotes really give a feel for the dedication that Dr. Fauci has towards infectious disease and towards humanity. You know, I was also sort of struck by the similarities between him and Senator Mansfield, for whom the Mansfield Center is named. Obviously, I didn't know Senator Mansfield personally, but boy, he's somebody I really, really admire. And I think in the area of politics, you know, both of them showed tremendous moral courage. They showed integrity, unbelievable integrity, which has followed them for decades, a desire to really to tell it like it is and be very frank about the problems that are facing us. You know, always to be optimistic, but, you know, at the same time, very, very realistic. So those were a couple of the things that stood out to me. One thing I want to note is Dr. Fauci noted how quickly the vaccine research was started. And in fact, I want to point out that the people at the Vaccine Research Center, as well as some of the scientists down here at Rocky Mountain Labs, began their investigations. And in the case of the vaccine, began developing the messenger RNA vaccine when all they really had was the nucleotide sequence of the virus, the RNA sequence of the virus. And so Dr. Corbett and Dr. Graham that worked for Dr. Fauci back in Bethesda, they actually began designing the messenger RNA vaccine, particularly the Moderna vaccine, before there were any samples of the actual coronavirus in the United States to study. That was really remarkable. The other thing I want to note is that he drew the point that the science really can only take us so far when we're talking about scientific advances like vaccines and antivirals. And although it's not the easiest thing for us, we all have to understand that we have science, and yet on the other hand, we have things like vaccine hesitancy and vaccine skepticism. And those are all really sociological problems. So we have to be able to balance the science and the sociology.
I would be interested in your own long experience with Tony Fauci. I mean, this is someone you've known and worked with for decades. What's he like just as a colleague and as a boss?
Well, I would say what you see is what you get. He's very, very direct. He is a hardworking guy. You know, he just turned 80. And he said, I think about 6 months ago, he says, I feel like I'm 45 and I act like I'm 35. He's out at the NIH very early in the morning. And he's usually the last one to leave. He's been to Montana a number of times. Every time I talk to him, he says, we got to plan a trip out there. I need to see what's going on at Rocky Mountain Labs. But he was out here in October of 2019, gave a public lecture down here in Hamilton. It didn't quite have 6,000 people there, but we had a really good audience of more than about 500. And he talked at that time about all of the presidents that he's worked with, pointing out that from President Reagan, and at that time, former President Trump was still president. And he pointed out at that time that every president that he's served under has had to deal with a major pandemic of one sort or another, starting back with HIV, Ebola virus, Zika virus, the anthrax attacks, and all of those kinds of things. At the end of his talk, he showed a slide of President Trump. Basically, he said, let me paraphrase, he said, I don't know what he's going to have to face, but I bet you he's going to have to face a pandemic before he leaves office. And boy, did he hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, he sure did. Marshall, it is a really cool thing that we have these labs here in Montana. I mean, I think a lot of people would look at that and say, oh, that's a little bit of an unlikely location. Yeah. Can you tell us just a little bit about why the labs were established, how they came to be located in the Bitterroot, and a bit about the work you and your colleagues do down there?
Well, the antecedents of Rocky Mountain Lab were established in the very early part of the 20th century to deal with what we would now call an emerging infectious disease, which was showing up in the people that were living down here. And it turned out to be something called Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, which was carried by a tick and is an infectious disease. Dr. Howard Ricketts figured that out. The scientists that he recruited to come out and continue his work continued that focus on emerging infectious diseases, which means brand new infectious diseases, and particularly with a focus on emerging infectious diseases, which were carried by arthropod vectors like ticks and fleas. And the catalog of the infectious disease advances which have been done down here is really kind of astounding. I don't really have time to go into it, but let me just name a couple of them. The bacteria that causes Lyme disease was identified here at Rocky Mountain Labs during the 1980s. The Ebola virus vaccine, which is now being deployed back in Guinea and some other parts of West Africa, was developed by a scientist named Dr. Heinz Feldman, who is now a laboratory chief here and runs our biosafety level 4 research program. Two of our scientists, Dr. Vincent Munster and Dr. Emmy DeWitt, recently received from the American Association for the Advancement of the Sciences, a very prestigious prize called the Golden Goose Award for their work on COVID-19. They were among the first two scientists in the United States to figure out that this was really going to be sort of a home run in the area of serious emerging infectious diseases. And in the intervening year, the work that's been done down here at Rocky Mountain Labs on COVID-19 in a variety of different areas has really turned out to be very cutting edge and really sort of setting the standard for the kind of quality work that the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases is known for.
Well, thanks for that, Marshall. And thanks just for all the work you and your team do at the Rocky Mountain Labs. And thank you especially for your help in putting together this event with us today. And with that, and on behalf of the Mansfield Center and the University of Montana, I would like to again extend a big thank you to Dr. Fauci, as well as a thank you to all of you out there across Montana and beyond for joining us for this session today.
You've been listening to A Conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the 2021 Mansfield Lecture from the University of Montana's Mansfield Center, which took place over Zoom on February 17, 2021. Following the discussion with Dr. Fauci, moderator Rob Saldin, who is the director of the Mansfield Center's Ethics and Public Affairs Program, continued the conversation with Dr. Marshall Bloom of Rocky Mountain Labs in Hamilton. On February 27th, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized Johnson & Johnson's single-shot COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use, beginning the rollout of the third effective vaccine available to Americans. Thanks to Dina Mansour, Rob Saldin, and Randy Edwards at the Mansfield Center for the audio of this talk. You can find the full Zoom event at the Mansfield Center's website. I'm Beth Ann Alstein. Thank you for listening.